Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Gus Cantavero, producer of In Context, and now Ken McDermott Rowe, the host.
Hi, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, and of course our producer, Gus Cantavero. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in wars around the world, and we show how these developments fit into the global geopolitical picture and how they affect U.S. national security. In today's show, we're going to talk in depth about the military policy implications of the huge Republican victory in the recent U.S. congressional elections. But first, let's look at some important stories that affect the military in the global situation. One, for instance, has to do with Israel, and Israel's been blown off the front pages in recent months due to the advances of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but it's not been quiet. Gus, what's been going on in Israel and Palestine?
Oh, wow. There's actually been a lot of crazy stuff going on since a few months ago when the recent Israeli-Palestinian conflict occurred. You know, they reached a long overdue ceasefire there. That kind of pushed things off the front page. But immediately afterward, probably within a week, Israel announced a whole slew of new settlements that they were going to start building in the West Bank. So that was on the other side, whereas Gaza was where the previous conflict was, and things were very quiet in the West Bank for a pretty long time. So this was kind of like rattling the cage, where they had just reached a ceasefire in Gaza, and now they were starting up in the West Bank, where the international community was really just begging Israel to just stop provoking the Palestinians. What happened in reaction to that was very recently, there was several knife attacks by Palestinian terrorists in Tel Aviv, where a policeman was killed and a couple of bystanders were killed as well. And then in reaction to that, because everything is reaction in Israel, there is never a beginning. There's just a continuation of events. And Israeli settlers, in reaction to the knife attacks, burned a very old mosque in the West Bank. And of course, Israel would like to eliminate the mosques in that area because they would like to reserve that for their own temples,
and of course, the expansion of Jewish settlements, or Israeli settlements in the West Bank, has been a critical part of
yes.
The problem there. When Jimmy Carter negotiated the Camp David,
exactly,
there were practically no Israeli settlements on the West Bank,
right.
And now there are hundreds of thousands of them. This has become
right.
a key issue. They're doing it in defiance of the international community, and it's interesting that very recently Sweden officially recognized the Palestinian state,
mm-hmm.
and this is very important because it's the first Western European
yes.
member of the EU to recognize Palestine. If you go online, you can look at a map of all the countries that have recognized Palestine, and it's 135 UN members now recognize Palestine as a state.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So this is, but this is the first time a Western European country as a member of the EU decided to do so. And this map also shows that pretty much it's the US and its allies in Western Europe that refuse to mm-hmm. recognize Palestine. The rest of the world does.
Right.
So slowly, the U.S. may be getting, and Israel getting isolated. Recently, French lawmakers said they were preparing a bill calling on the French government to recognize Palestine. Mm-hmm. And in mid-October, the British Parliament overwhelmingly passed a motion that the government, the U.K. government, should recognize the state of Palestine alongside the state of Israel. Public opinion in the world is slowly moving, I think, and we'll have to see how far this goes.
Just a few days ago, on November 17th, Haaretz released an article. It says, the headline is, EU document suggests recalling envoys if Israeli settlement threatened two-state solution. The subhead is a two-page document includes two chapters of sticks to be used against Israel, a chapter of carrots for the Palestinians. I really hate when they use infantile language like that. It goes on to say that the European Union will pursue sanctions by basically cutting diplomatic ties with Israel if they continue to
produce the settlements. This is very interesting, Marshawn, because we see maybe, at least on the Palestinian issue, the Europeans are inching towards a policy which is a little independent of the United States. But at the same time, NATO has intercepted a lot of Russian overflights in Western Europe. Could you talk about that and its impact on NATO?
Absolutely. Well, there have been over 100 encounters with the Russian Air Force in international waters and on the edge, or should I say international airspace, I'm sorry, and on the edge of NATO airspace. This includes encounters in the Baltics, near Danish airspace, and indeed actually near Canadian and U.S. airspace. There were encounters off the coast of California. So this is demonstrating a much more bold policy on the part of the Russians, and it is allowing them to sort of test our responses, test our capabilities.
What do the Russians hope to gain from this?
For the Russians, it's part of long-term planning. I mean, right now we tend to see this as sort of Cold War posturing, but a lot has changed since the Cold War, and we really are entering a new era of relations with the Russians in terms of the hostility and intensity. During the Cold War, both we and the Russians were evenly matched militarily. We had a massive army in Western Europe, the Russians had a massive army in Eastern Europe, and the fact is that neither side really wanted a war. Both sides planned for a defensive war, and what we kind of poked and prodded at each other via proxy, and indeed poked and prodded at each other in the air, there was no sense that the Russians were going to sweep across into Western Europe, nor the NATO was going to sweep across into Eastern Europe, because the war would be so catastrophic that even if one side won, they would still lose. And also at the time, we still viewed nukes as a deterrent. But as one could see, I mean, nuclear capabilities, we still have an incredibly large nuclear arsenal, yet the Russians are being more aggressive than ever. And I think it's because largely our nuclear deterrent really isn't a deterrent anymore. And I think the Russians are becoming more bolder because they're testing us.
This could also be in response to our ever-increasing military training exercises in Eastern Europe, which are clearly meant to be a warning to Russia with respect to its support for the Ukrainian secessionists.
Well, that's true, but the Russians are playing the same game. They held military drills in November with the Serbian army, the first joint military exercises ever conducted between the Serbians and the Russians, at least since the end of the Cold War, when Serbia was part of Yugoslavia. But I think what this is about is a broader power play between the U.S. and Russia. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. has had a policy of really trying to hem in Russia. Now, under the Bush administration, there was a cooling of relations between the U.S. and Russia, and indeed, many ways, a respect for spheres of influence. As we saw during the Orange Revolution, the pro-democracy movement in Ukraine, the United States allowed that to fall and allowed the Russians to put in a pro-Russian leader because it was sort of an understanding that this was in Russia's sphere of influence. Well, now the interventions in Ukraine by NATO, by the United States, have demonstrated that we no longer respect that sphere of influence. Now, Russia backed into a corner is a very dangerous creature because the Russians are paranoid of not only invasion, but of being surrounded. And we're really pushing them to a point where they've been left no alternative other than to push back.
They do overflights in Western Europe and over places that we feel that make us feel threatened. What's the military significance of that? What do you do to stop it? And what would be the next step? Is there a next step?
Human history is an existence of hurtling from one major war to another. The only way we can truly stop this confrontational approach is to guarantee Russia its security and a sphere of influence. A lot of people like to make the distinction that, oh, well, this is like Hitler's Anschluss in the 1930s. And in many ways, it bears similarities, but we forget the Russians are not Germans. The Russians, their number one fear is their security. The whole reason why they created the Eastern Bloc, the Warsaw Pact, was to create a buffer zone with the West. I'm not arguing that by any stretch Russia's actions are altruistic, but the fact is that if we could sit down with the Russians and say, okay, just as Truman did with Stalin, sit down and say, look, we might not agree with each other, but here's your sphere, you know, Ukraine, Belarus, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, things like that. And then we have ours, this is NATO. You know, well, you cross into NATO, there will be trouble. The problem that we have now is that we're not respecting the principle of spheres of influence. We clearly have a very hostile stance towards Russia. And the next step, if this continues to escalate, is more and more overt confrontation.
So what do you think of the Russian plans to have long-range bombers in the Gulf of Mexico? Do we know when these flights are going to start?
No, we don't.
And where would they be based?
Well, they could be based anywhere, really. I mean, they could be based in Venezuela. We know the Russians have troops in Venezuela. They could be based even out of Cuba. We know they have troops in Cuba. They have a listening post and an intelligence post in Cuba. They could also fly them from Russian airspace across the Atlantic.
So this is serious pushback with the base in Venezuela. And as we covered a few shows ago, the reopening of a huge intel station in Cuba that it was closed after the end of the Cold War.
Once again, this proves why it's time to end the embargo against Cuba. You know, free trade with Cuba and increased relations is a really good way to secure your borders.
Well, exactly. You know, you want to have better relations with your neighbors. But the other thing, too, is understanding your adversaries. I mean, again, as I said, Russia is not Germany. The other thing we need to understand, too, is likewise, this is not the Soviet Union. They're not afraid of our nukes. There was actually a interesting article. Again, it's got no play in the U.S. media, but it was reported namely in a newspaper called The Local, which is Denmark's main English newspaper. It had basically an information piece released by the Danish military intelligence stating that Russia was conducting simulated attacks against Denmark. Now, this it shows a massive escalation in not only the rhetoric, but in the preparation, because every war is about preparation. Denial doesn't change the fact that when you go to war, you need to be prepared.
Against this backdrop of the Russian expansion, we note that the United States Army is being cut significantly. This year, the force is cut to 508,000 from 530,000, and there are plans to trim an additional 20,000 troops next year. And eventually, the plan calls that for in the year 2019, that the United States Army will have only 450,000 troops, which is the smallest force since World War II. What do you make of that, Marchand?
You know, the whole idea is that all wars are going to be fought with technology. But as you can see, we can't defeat ISIS simply from the air. We're expanding the ground force tremendously in Iraq because, you know, you can't defeat an enemy just with drones. But the problem is the prevailing logic is that you can. The other issue that's presented by this rapid decrease is that we can't fight a major conflict. I think it's very telling of the psychology of our politicians, because what it says is that our politicians sincerely believe that there will never be another global conflict that we simply can't smother out with just a few drones. I mean, I think there's been a level of arrogance created because really fundamentally for the last 20 years, we've been fighting nations that have a very second-rate military. A lot of it's crossing our fingers and trusting our luck and saying, well, we really won't go to war with the Russians. We really don't have to worry about China, you know, sort of a thing. And I think that's why we're so complacent in decreasing the size of our military.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marchand McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Canavero, our producer. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month at noon. Of course, the size of the military is a bone of contention between the two parties, which brings us to the recent Republican victory in the congressional elections in the United States, where the Republicans won control of the U.S. Senate and increased their majority in the House of Representatives to a level not seen since World War II. And as a result of this election in January, Republicans will replace Democrats as chairs of all the Senate committees, including the important Armed Services Committee, where John McCain will replace Carl Levin. He's an exponent of a fairly muscular foreign policy, military policy, shall we say.
You're very diplomatic.
Whereas Carl Levin, the outgoing chairman of the committee, opposed the 2003 Iraq War, and he's called for cost controls and military procurement and closing some bases to save money. McCain, of course, supported the Iraq War. Marchand and Gus, what do you think are going to be the longer-term effects of the shift in power in the Congress, especially in the Senate?
John McCain, who has never seen a war he hasn't liked. He's never seen a bomb that he hasn't loved. He is a very, very suspicious person in that he has given a lot of speeches, a lot of interviews where he said that he supports these moderate rebels in Syria and he knows them personally. And there's photos of him shaking hands with these guys. If he knew them, he would also know that they were in cahoots with Al-Qaeda of Iraq, which is essentially ISIS. And this is all a pot of stew, basically. All right. So there's a bunch of ingredients and they make up a stew. He has no idea how to discern one from another because he thinks that he understands the situation. He really has no grasp of it whatsoever. So he's going to come into the Armed Services Committee and he's going to say, we need to bomb. We need troops on the ground. You know, we need to increase the airstrikes. He wants a no-fly zone over Syria. And all of this is going to be paid for by the American checkbook. And you're just talking about withdrawing and downsizing the American military. And you know what? I'm for it. Because it means that we have to close bases. It means that we have to stop intervening. And it's outside of the bounds of the American Constitution and is not our responsibility. And it's also inhumane to be able to go around and dictate to people how they should live. The other person is Bob Corker, who's a representative the Republican from Tennessee. And he's going to take over the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he is, I read a transcript of an interview of a town hall where he talked about foreign policy, and he was much more reserved than John McCain.
Yes.
Although, you know, if you read the liberal left media, they're going to lump them in together. Bob Corker is not going to back down from the intervention, but he's also going to say that it's very expensive. We're going to have to pay for it.
He seems to be more sophisticated than
the
king.
He's much more sophisticated.
Although Armed Services, as I understand it, is the committee that's going to have the most influence over the conduct of our military policy.
Yes, the Foreign Relations Committee, he has a lot more to say about the Iran deal, for example. Again, that's something that I think that they need to get this nuclear deal with Iran done now, because you're going to have these lackeys for AIPAC, i.e. John McCain, rattle the sabers and say that Iran is our enemy and we need to put more pressure on them, as if you can put more pressure on Iran. And what's going to end up happening is that they're just going to retreat to the other side and cozy up with Russia, China, whoever, and they're going to cite their own national sovereignty and go ahead and build nuclear weapons if that's what they want to do. And we're not going to have a damn thing to say about it. So really, there's a deal on the table that's very, very good for America. It's good for what the American stated goal is, right? And that is a demilitarized zone. So they should take it. They really should take it, and they should take it now.
Marshawn, what do you think of the significance of John McCain taking over the Armed Services Committee?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we're dealing with two parties from a military standpoint that are completely out of touch with reality. Again, as I mentioned, we can't fight any kind of war with drones, and war is going to be an inevitable aspect of human existence. But at the same time, we can't also go provoking a major military power like Russia with drones at a 400,000-man army. Really what we need, and what I don't hear either side saying, is that we need to have a strong military, but we need to have a military that's first focused on defending the homeland before we can worry about defending Western Europe or defending other allied nations. We poke and prod at the Russians, and they make bomber flights. According to CNN, the defense minister of Russia said, yeah, we're going to start increasing our military presence in the Caribbean, in Latin America. What are you going to do about it? And the fact is, if we have a 400,000-man army and the bulk of those troops are in the Middle East, who's left to defend the homeland? And that's why I really don't see much of a fundamental difference right now between the Republicans and the Democrats, is both are saying we're in favor of antagonizing the Russians. But the thing is, we kind of differ on who's going to be more aggressive. Again, and similar with our approach to Iran, I had an article, an op-ed piece published in the Army Times a couple weeks ago. And in it, one of the things I stated was realpolitik. What you have to do is you have to make allies with some people you might not necessarily like. We did that during World War II. We were friends with the Soviets, and we had spent the previous 20 years fighting them in a very literal sense in the Russian Civil War, and then in much more economic sense, in diplomatic sense, post-Russian Civil War. But the fact is that we became friends because we knew the Nazis were a greater threat. In a similar vein, one of the things we should do is we need to reach out to the Iranians and the Syrians and say, look, we have a common enemy. ISIS is a very dangerous enemy. It shouldn't have been allowed to grow as much as it has. We can still squash it. Instead of having this lunatic idea that we're going to support these Syrian rebels, who, by the way, are selling their American-made Stingers to ISIS, instead of doing that, what we need to do is say to the Syrian government, okay, look, we don't like you, you don't like us, but we have a common enemy. The same thing with the Iranians. And most importantly, the Russians have no love of ISIS. Bring in the Russians. Because if we and the Russians come there as a stabilizing factor, look, Russia is the one who supplies Iran with arms. Who's building or who's promised to build new nuclear reactors in Iran or for Iran? It's Russia. If you get Iran's a proxy. Right. If you bring Russia in on our side against ISIS, Russia will reign in Iran. And again, history. Why do we have the warmest relations with the Russians under the Bush administration? Why is it the Russians withdrew almost all of their intelligence assets from Cuba under Putin when Bush was president? It's because there was an understanding that we guarantee your sovereignty and your national integrity. We're not going to try to overthrow you. We're not going to try to put NATO missiles in Ukraine. We're not going to try to put NATO troops in Georgia. But then Obama becomes president, and what's the first thing we try to do in both instances?
So we have two interventionist parties. It's not much of a choice.
No, they choose, it's just the choice of which intervention, as to the angle of intervention. It's a hegemonic entity. They just argue about which intervention to undertake. Now, the thing with allying with Iran and Syria to crush ISIS, it makes perfect military strategic sense. You're exactly right. If that's the stated goal, to get rid of ISIS. However, don't forget, AIPAC and the Israel lobby is a humongous influence, and they would pull out all the stops to prevent an alliance.
And in
with
fact, Israel's
Iran.
Interests were cited by some of the Republicans who took the TV right after the election was over to denounce President Obama's overtures to Iran,
right.
including Senator McCain, Senator Lindsey Graham,
shocking,
foreign UN Ambassador John Bolton, a frequent neocon spokesman for the Republicans. They all said that it was an absolute outrage that Obama should be attempting to cooperate with Iran. And they made statements like, this will offend our Sunni allies. And as we've discussed in previous shows, it's our Sunni allies, am I correct, Marchand, that have been funding ISIS?
Yeah, Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. It's been Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, the UAE. They've been the ones who've been supplying arms. And let's not forget, during the Iraq War, they were the ones supplying arms to ISIS, was at the time called ISI, Islamic State in Iraq. So this isn't a new organization. They've been around for a while. And during that time, they were being supplied with money from emirs, Sunni emirs, that were our allies. And the Republicans don't have any better answer, at least at this stage. They're picking these ne'er-do-well allies who are sponsoring our enemies. I mean, it's completely counterintuitive. It'd be like us arming North Vietnam to help in the struggle against, you know,
So why do they do it? What's their game? Do they have all these restive Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia and they figure let's give them a fight abroad so they don't bother us at home? Is that the theory?
I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it, even though ISIS's stated goal has been the overthrow of the Saudi regime, Saudi Arabia doesn't want to see is a strong Shia Iraq. The Saudi regime, and I call them a regime because they are an authoritarian system that persecutes Muslims as well as non-Muslims, but the Saudi regime is only interested in its survival, and it's petrified of a strong Shia government in Iraq and in Syria. So it's kind of the case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They don't particularly like ISIS because ISIS wants to get rid of them. On the other hand, they want to see the Shia wiped out.
Well, it's turmoil.
They probably figure, exactly, and they probably figure that since they're bankrolling ISIS, they can pull that rug out from under their feet. And the other thing is, it is true, it gets rid of a lot of their own restive Wahhabis because it sends them to Iraq instead. And it also means that ISIS may very well feel that it owes the Saudis, at least in their mind. You know, the Saudis will, or the Wahhabis will owe the Saudi government because they were the ones bankrolling them. I mean, the fact is that this whole policy that we have in the Middle East right now is completely lunatic. It is completely counterintuitive. It's the same as our policy in Eastern Europe. We're backing a neo-Nazi, Poroshenko. Yanukovych was a Russian puppet. But now we got a neo-Nazi puppet that wants to ethnically cleanse Eastern Ukraine, or whose supporters have claimed that they want to ethnically cleanse Eastern Ukraine of ethnic Russians.
Isn't that who John McCain supports, by the way?
Well, exactly. In fact, Yulia Tymoshenko, she was the one who they touted out as being, you know, the great democratic leader. Well, the FSB, the Russian Security Services, released tapes, and this has been all over the Western media as well, released tapes of a phone call that bugged between her and another important Ukrainian official where she said we should nuke and flatten and wipe out and erase all of the Russians from Eastern Ukraine, something in the words, we should incinerate them. This is insane. We're aligning ourselves with people who do not hold to our values, people who are undemocratic, and people who are genocidal. And the other thing to mention, too, is what this all has an effect of doing is it pushes the Iranians and the Syrians into Russia's arms, and it pushes the Russians into China's arms. And Russia's a Western country. The Russians have very little in common with the Chinese. The Chinese are atheistic communists, and Russia, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has become a multicultural, multi-religious society. Yet, as reported in Itar Tass on November 17th, Russian and Chinese officials are discussing stronger military cooperation. This is only because we are pushing all of these other countries into one corner in favor of what? Neo-Nazis and Islamic fundamentalists? They're not challenging him on Ukraine. They're not challenging him on Iraq. And they're not challenging him on the fact that Obama has fought more undeclared wars without asking Congress than any other president before.
It's very much an interventionist. If we look at his actual policy in Iraq, he's bombing daily in support of the Iraqi army. He just said he was going to send another 1,500 U.S. troops to Iraq, and they're going to be deployed in combat areas. They're supposedly not combat troops, but they're going to be advisors in combat areas. his Joint Chief of Staff Chairman, General Martin Dempsey, said that he's considering sending U.S. combat troops to Iraq.
Yeah.
So I don't see how he could be much more aggressive.
But don't forget, it's not mission creep.
It's not, yeah. So so I don't know what the Republicans would do that would be more aggressive than what Obama's doing. Where is the party of Dennis Kucinich or the party of Rand Paul or Ron Paul,
yeah.
someone who's going to give us a real alternative
They're ignored.
To the interventionist policy. And of course, if you look at the major media in America, you don't see any debate. There is no spokesman for the anti-interventionist side. It's just a question of what kind of bombs do we drop
and where. No, in fact, the anti-intervention crowd, and I know this because I read them and listen to them every day, is labeled as racist. Because they don't want to help the poor Yazidis,
right?
Or
right.
Insert name here, you know?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Canavero, our producer. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month at noon. In this show, we bring to you very important news regarding military and geopolitical events around the world, which impact U.S. national security. We try to explain the significance of these events in ways that go into more depth than in the corporate media, and we also try to put them into a historical context so that you can make some sense of them.
People really don't care anymore. And that's something that strikes me. People are disillusioned with both parties. Mm-hmm. Particularly a lot of conservatives I talk to are very disillusioned with the Republican Party. The problem is, number one, they don't feel that there's an alternative. But number two, probably most importantly, most people feel that doesn't really apply to them. I mean, whether we go back into Iraq or not, for most people, doesn't really matter because who goes to fight? It's volunteers. It's professional soldiers. We have some of the bravest men and women in uniform right now. Instead of being utilized to defend our homeland, they're being sent to defend Latvia. They're being sent to Ukraine to defend Ukraine. They're not being sent to defend the United States, which is what they should be doing.
Marshawn, you mentioned earlier that ISIS has been around for a while, and I think to understand how it's expanded so rapidly in Iraq and Syria, one really needs to look at ISIS's origins. It's something that Senator McCain doesn't seem to be aware of. Could you talk about where ISIS came from and its role during the American occupation of Iraq?
When the United States invaded Iraq, we made some very, very crucial mistakes. I'm not sure if many of our listeners are familiar with the process of denazification that took place in Germany post-World War II. One of the things we did is we arrested a lot of senior Nazi officials, but we kept the judicial system intact. We kept the police force intact. We kept the military intact by and large. And there was sort of that wink and nod like, yeah, we know you were a Nazi, but whatever, you run the Department of Light and Power. Whereas there wasn't that in Iraq. We went into Iraq and had this idea of de-Baathification. Almost all Sunnis were members of the Ba'ath Party because it was the only way to get a job. And Sunnis were the only ones that were allowed to be members of the Ba'ath Party. So when we went into de-Ba'athification, everyone lost their jobs, whether you were in the military, the police, the government, or whether you were a school teacher, you lost your job as a Ba'athist. And then we brought in the Shiites who had no experience at running government. Okay, you run the government. I don't care how well-intentioned you are. If you don't have any experience running government, you can't. And so the Sunnis felt disillusioned. They really felt that the occupation was an attack on them, which it wasn't an attack on the Sunnis. It was just a completely bungled de-Ba'athification process. But as a result, the Sunnis turned to the resistance. The strongest resistance movement to emerge became ISI, Islamic State in Iraq, and they became famous for their fighting in the Battle of Fallujah, which for them was kind of like their Alamo. It was ISI takes on the army, the Marines, it takes on the Americans. And they bloodied our noses really badly in Fallujah. So this gave ISIS really more or less its street cred, if you will. As the occupation ended, ISI very, very much began to lie low. They sort of, their leadership had taken a bit of a beating during the war, and they started to lie low. But when the Syrian civil war emerged, they saw an opportunity and they left Iraq to go fight in Syria. And where they received a lot of their money and a lot of their arms from was other Syrian groups like the Al-Nusra Front and the Free Syrian Army and people that we were giving guns to, which is one of the reasons why they have so much money.
So some of these groups you're talking about, like the Al-Nusra, these are radical Wahhabi groups, rapidly anti-Western, and they're fighting alongside the people we're supposedly supporting, the moderate Free Syrian Army, right? So all these guys are mixed up, and the guns are going from one group to another, I suppose. Is that right?
Exactly. It was an utter catastrophe because also during the war in Iraq, ISI had been receiving a tremendous amount of money from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, so on and so forth. And they would continue to receive that money once they were fighting the Syrian government. One of the things that you can really glean from all of this is that ISIS was awash with money from all sides. And now even more so because a lot of these people that we are giving guns to, the so-called moderates, again, this isn't like the Free French Army under Charles de Gaulle, you know, a united coalition. It's a coalition of many different organizations. And when these organizations decide, you know, we benefit more from being with ISIS, they take those American guns, American TOW missiles, American Stingers, and give them over to their new partners. Once Assad's out of power, if he were to be removed, which I think is highly unlikely given the amount of Russian arms and military advisors in Syria, but let's say hypothetically Assad were to be kicked out, ISIS would then roll over the Free Syrian Army, and indeed they probably give these guys an offer they can't refuse. ISIS as itself now has grown into fundamentally a state. It has all the arms of government, which again what separates it from organizations like Al-Qaeda or indeed even the Taliban. They brought back all the bureaucrats from the Saddam days.
Why are they working together, do you think, the important Baathists in Iraq with ISIS?
Well, they don't like the Shia. That is probably the most important thing is they don't like the Shia. They don't like the Americans. And for a lot of them, it's a career move. I mean, again, these Baathists were not Baathists because they were ideologically hardcore. They were Baathists because they were opportunists. And these same opportunists would gladly work for ISIS as they would work for Saddam. It's also important to note in terms of ISIS expansion, a group called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis in the Sinai, which means champions of Jerusalem, they have pledged allegiance to the caliph, to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And by the way, when I say caliph, that's his self-imposed title. He is not by any stretch an Islamic caliph.
We use that term loosely.
Exactly, very loosely. But the fact is, though, is that they have pledged their allegiance. When these organizations pledge allegiance, it does not mean that, you know, oh, yeah, we'll be your friends. It's called in Arabic giving bay'ah. Bay'ah is more than an oath of allegiance, just saying, yeah, we agree to get along. It is a pledge of subservience that you will follow this individual, which means that it's now expanded into the Sinai. And this organization is the same organization that killed 30 Egyptian soldiers. ISIS, it is now a nation state in the sense that it has the administration, it has the military, and it's expanding at an unbelievable rate.
These guys seem so much more sophisticated than the Wahhabi groups that we've been used to hearing about, really since the 80s in Afghanistan. These guys are well-financed, and I understand they come into a town in Iraq with their computer or laptops, and they have good intel, and they can quickly find out from their own sources who in this town fought with the Americans, for the Americans, in this so-called awakening group, where we would pay off Sunni tribesmen to fight for us. And then they find them and they eliminate them. So they're really formidable. And it's a whole new ball game. This caliphate concept, could you talk about what does that mean?
The Islamic caliphate is the Islamic nation. It's meant to encompass all peoples of the Islamic faith under one leader, the caliph. There are different interpretations based on the Sunnis and the Shia, but the fundamental principle is still the same. The most recent caliphate was the Ottoman Empire, which disintegrated in 1924 when Turkey became no longer the Ottoman Empire and became Turkey. Before the Ottoman Empire, you had the Abbasids, the Umayyads, you had other caliphates. So this is not a new concept.
This
Islam.
Is going back to the early centuries of Islam. We're talking the 8th, 9th century, and then the Ottomans held sway from like the 14th century, 15th century. They conquered Constantinople. They were really big players for a long time until it was dissolved in the aftermath of World War One, and it
exactly.
was a great and unifying force in the region. And we've often talked about that, Marshawn, how it would be in our U.S. interest to have regional stability there. But I don't think we expected it to come from a group like ISIS.
Again, we have to look at Islamic history. Islam is not a medieval religion, and the concept of the caliphate is not a medieval one. When we look at the Ottoman courts were centers of learning and knowledge, scientific and engineering feats. I mean, let's not forget, when the rest of the world was in the Dark Ages, the caliphates were discovering things like brain surgery, or rediscovering them from the times of the Romans. But the fact is that the caliphate, actually, I believe this was the Abbasids, had worked on a method for treating mental illness using music. The caliphate historically has been a golden age for the Muslim world. The thing is that this group ISIS has taken, on the one hand, the hopes and dreams of the Muslim world, because the Muslim world has been in pretty much perpetual war since the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1924, and has been impoverished and exploited by superpowers and whatnot, and carved up. So here comes ISIS and says, we're going to restore the caliphate. And so what people want to see is an Ottoman Empire, but what they're getting is a more or less medieval state. But the problem is that they don't realize that until ISIS walks into town, which is one of the reasons why they get so much support. Because when, you know, ISIS beheads a whole lot of people, people who are sympathetic to them probably write it off as, oh, well, that's American propaganda. I mean, I've known a lot of Arabs, and often when something unflattering would come out about an Arab country, they just blame it on American propaganda. And I'm sure that happens. And then ISIS comes to town and they go, oh my gosh, these people are barbarians.
Mm-hmm. It's not a very appetizing picture, but one scenario that could unfold is you will have this fundamentalist Sunni caliphate occupying, let's say, Syria, Iraq, parts of Iraq, but you have a Shia majority in Iraq. And of course you have next to it, just to the east, you have Iran, and they're obviously not going to want anything to do with the Sunni caliphate. So you could have a new power system where kind of in the center, on the western side of the Mideast, you've got the Sunni caliphate. And on the eastern side, you've got this enlarged Iran, which is the protector of the Shia majority in Iraq. Is that a possible scenario?
I don't think so. Only reason why I say is because of ISIS's inherent expansionist nature. It doesn't see itself as ending with, you know, stopping with northern Iraq and letting the south of Iraq and Baghdad and other regions like that go. They want to wipe out the Shia. Ultimately, what they want to do is march into Mecca and Medina, the two holiest cities in Islam, and then have, you know, the Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi stand in the Kaaba in Mecca, which is a big black box that all Muslims pray to, believe it was built by Prophet Abraham. You know, stand there and say, I'm the leader of the Muslim world, and have, you know, Muslims from Indonesia to Morocco follow him. He is not going to stop, and ISIS is not going to stop, unless, of course, it is met with such strong military force that it crumbles.
Where would that force come from? The Iraqi government is now, in my sense, is it seen as a continuing tool of the American occupation. So the Sunni Baathists, who really are not fundamentalist Islamists, are siding with ISIS as a way of resisting the occupation. Is that the way, do you see it that way, Marshawn?
Part of it's misplaced idealism. Part of it is opportunism. Part of it is anti-Shiism. And I think a large part of it is trying to pick sides, because if you're a Sunni and you join ISIS, as long as you keep your head down and do what they tell you, you're going to be fine. Maybe they'll end the anarchy. You don't know. But the biggest thing is that as long as you keep your head down, these guys roll in with guns. You don't have any. They roll in with tanks. You don't have any. As long as you're a Sunni, you know you can just kind of keep your head down. You'll be okay. The biggest problem for us right now is that the Iraqi army they're holding their own, but they don't have the capability of striking back. Really, an additional 100,000 American troops is not going to stop it by itself. What you need is a coalition, and a coalition of meaningful nations. I'm talking about, on the one hand, Iran and Syria, and on the other hand, also bringing in Russia and the Europeans. The reason why I say this is because that would bring it down the necessary military force. The Iranians, the Iraqis, and the Syrians could provide the ground troops. Americans, Europeans, and indeed Russians provide the air power. But the most important thing is this sends a message. In addition to the destruction of ISIS, sends a message to the Arab nations that the West, to include Russia, supports stability. You side with stability, you will prosper. It encourages stability, because let's not forget, Syria and Iran are not, quote unquote, rogue nations alone. They are proxies of Russia. If Russia steps in and says, look, Assad, Iranian leadership, we guarantee your survivability, but you got to play ball with the West, they will. You can do business
Marshawn,
with them. And
I think we're going to have to see it. If this ISIS can continue its amazing expansion, if it continued to have apparently strong support amongst the Baathists in Iraq. But I'd like to move on for a few minutes to talk about the Ukraine, which we've been talking about in recent months, because the Republicans have also been very critical of President Obama's policy in Ukraine, which, of course, is in the aftermath of a U.S.-backed coup earlier this year, in which the elected pro-Russian president of the Ukraine was replaced with a pro-Western leader. And the Russian ethnics of Eastern Ukraine seceded from Ukraine, and they recently held their own elections there, elections opposed by the central government in Kiev and opposed by the United States, but supported by Russia. Russia brokered a ceasefire in Ukraine. Has that ceasefire held up?
Not remotely. There's been heavy shelling by Ukrainian forces on the rebel regions. There's been ambushes by the rebels on Ukrainian forces. The ceasefire has been absolutely meaningless. The U.S. media talks about, the ceasefire is breaking down. No, the ceasefire ceases to exist. The only thing that's stopping it from breaking out into all-out war is the fact that the Ukrainian army hasn't launched a massive offensive, which, according to several news outlets, President Petro Poroshenko and his Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk have been discussing launching an all-out offensive against the rebels of eastern Ukraine. An important thing to understand when looking at the situation in Ukraine in terms of why, you know, we wonder, well, it's just Russian expansionism. Well, let's face it. If, let's say, a Russian-backed Mexican government was slaughtering Americans in Mexico and the Russians were putting troops on the ground in Mexico, we might feel a little threatened by that. In the same vein, the Russians feel threatened by are backing of Poroshenko and Poroshenko's threat to launch an offensive. Poroshenko's forces are dropping cluster munitions, which have been outlawed by most Western nations except the United States and a few others. This entity is the one we're backing, which, by the way, it's also worth mentioning, our whole opposition to Assad is because he bombs his own people and is committing genocide. Well, that's pretty much what the Ukrainian regime is doing as well.
NATO claims that Russia now has troops in eastern Ukraine. Do you think that that's true?
It explains the massive military successes on the part of the eastern Ukrainian forces. I remember reading a piece written by Rasmussen, the former head of NATO, and he said we have aerial footage, reconnaissance footage, showing that the Russian tanks have crossed the border, Russian artillery is being used to great effect in the east, and most importantly, recently, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, has witnessed Russian tanks. Also, again, to add to that, I've seen plenty of amateur footage personally of Russian T-90 battle tanks rolling down the streets towards Mariupol, the very important port city that's very nearly surrounded by pro-Russian forces. It's currently in the hands of the Ukrainian government. And these tanks are some of the latest Russian T-90 battle tanks, which, again, you can't put an idiot in and say, not to imply that Eastern Ukrainians are idiots, but I mean, you can't put you can't put an untrained coal miner into a T-90 battle tank and expect him to be able to drive it. It takes a tremendous amount of expertise to operate any kind of military hardware, field artillery, tanks, and whatnot. And so, I mean, I have no doubt at all that the Russians have troops there.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Cadavero, our producer. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, IncontextReport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month at noon. Marshawn, one very important event that occurred a few weeks ago was an address by the leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin, to an organization called the Valdai International Discussion Club. Some commentators have called his address there the equivalent of Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech in 1946, which essentially was seen as the beginning of a Cold War. And just to give a little background, this Valdai International Discussion Club was set up by the Russians a few years ago, and it's an open forum in which journalists and scholars from around the world are invited to ask questions of Russian leaders, to critique and discuss and publish transcripts the policies of Russia, its global objectives. During his presentation, President Putin said the outbreak of a global war is almost inevitable, and he blames the United States for fragmenting the regional global security system. Could you comment on the significance of President Putin's remarks?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is for the first time a major world leader, and we're not talking Kim Jong-un in North Korea. This is a major world leader acknowledging that a major global conflict is inevitable, and he's using historical examples because in terms of breakdown in global order, before the outbreak of World War II, we forget the Japanese marched out of the League of Nations and showed that the League of Nations, which was meant to prevent another major global war, was absolutely meaningless. We're seeing the same thing, in essence, happening at present with the United Nations. The United Nations Security Council has proved that it's absolutely meaningless. The means of international order is starting to break down because the balance of military powers has become uneven. When we look at major wars throughout history, one of the things you see is that there is a superpower or a group of superpowers on the ascendancy and several on the decline. During the Cold War, both Russia and the United States were even. We were evenly matched, meaning that war was not opportune for either side. But on the other hand, what we see now is Russia is on the ascendancy militarily, and the U.S. is drastically on the descendancy, as is
although
NATO and the European
our perception
powers.
Is quite the opposite. And recently, former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev said, quote, "The world is on the brink of a new Cold War." He said, due to the fact that the West had, quote, succumbed to triumphalism, and he expressed alarm about what's going on in the Mideast and the European conflicts. But really, this was a deliberate decision made at the end of the Cold War by the administration of Bush Sr. Of course, the Cold War had been won largely because of the defense spending under the administration of Ronald Reagan. Mikhail Gorbachev threw in the towel. He unilaterally repealed the Brezhnev Doctrine, which asserted that the Soviet Union had the right to control the governments of Eastern Europe. He legalized opposition parties in the Soviet Union. He allowed free elections, and he made the Soviet Union a voluntary association. It was a golden moment for world peace, and immediately George Bush Sr. invaded the Persian Gulf. And it was clearly, I think, what Gorbachev was saying, that was Western triumphalism. The West, in the United States in particular, our attitude was, we won the Cold War. Now we are the world's sole superpower, yeah. And we are going to reap the benefits of that position. And I think that it was that 1990, 1991, when Gorbachev was destabilized, Boris Yeltsin, who was really looking out for the West's interest, was put in his place as a leader of Russia. Soviet Union collapsed. And then we saw the deterioration, really the plundering of the former Soviet Union by the Western financial interests, and the rapid military expansion of the West, first in the Persian Gulf, then in breaking up Yugoslavia. Soon thereafter, the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, the conquest of Libya, the insurrection we supported in Syria. It's really been a dramatic break in what had been a relatively stable period during the Cold War.
And all this time, Russia was regrouping, restabilizing, retooling, developing, advancing,
Certainly since Yeltsin was replaced by Putin.
In the last 15 to 20 years, in that amount of time, they've gone through restabilizing their economy and growth, invention.
That's right.
They're what they are because America has been spending money like drunken sailors after they won the Cold War. They're spiking the football, running around, lighting fires and celebrating the Super Bowl.
But if you listen to John McCain and Lindsey Graham and John Bolton, you would think, Marshawn, that we are still the world's sole superpower and that Russia is really a third-rate military power.
It's a paper tiger right now.
So what do you think the U.S. military policy should be at this point?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to get out of our post-Cold War stupor. I mean, the fact is that, as I mentioned, General Scales talked about, we defeated the Russian tanks in the Gulf War. Well, yeah, those were T-72 battle tanks from the 70s and 80s. Russia has massively rearmed, has been making incredible strides militarily in terms of its Bore-class submarines, stealth fighter bombers, and T-90 battle tanks, something we really need to take seriously. What our approach really needs to be to Russia is the same that that Truman had with Stalin, a sit down and listen, let's establish spheres of influence. Because again, Russia is not like Germany. They are not looking for Lebensraum for the new Rus. What they are looking for is ensuring their security and the security of ethnic Russians. And if we could guarantee them that and say, okay, we're not going to let the Moldovan army march into Transnistria. Okay, Transnistria will still be Transnistria, but the ethnic Russians.
Our listeners who don't know, where are these places?
Moldova borders Romania, is in Eastern Europe, and there's a breakaway region called Transnistria, which is made up predominantly of ethnic Russians. Moldovans are ethnically Romanian, but it's a Russian enclave. So we guaranteed, okay, they have security, and there are the ethnic Russians in Abkhazia and South Ossetia in northern Georgia. They're safe. We're not going to allow anyone to purge them. However, if you cross into Western Europe, there will be war, and that's where we have to have a very strong military to act as a deterrent. So on the one hand, Russia can balance out, well, cooperation with the United States guarantees our security. Confrontation with them would guarantee a bloody conflict in which neither side would win. And that is how you would prevent a conflict. The problem is we have this illusion that Russia is a third world country, which, I mean, we're just deluding ourselves. And again, we look at Putin and we say, oh, well, he's just an old communist. Well, the fact is that Russians were very alienated post-Cold War, because what people don't read about is the mass starvation which occurred in Russia after the end of the Cold War. The economy collapsed, there were bread lines, crime was rampant, but most importantly, people were starving to death. I saw a little documentary that was talking about people who lived on the Sakhalin Islands, which are right off the coast of Eastern Russia, very cold and inhospitable. Before Putin came to power, But before Putin came to power, they had no electricity. They had no hot running water. They had no heating. In fact, they interviewed this elderly woman who said, I don't know how I can go on living. I can never take my coat off. It never gets above freezing in my own house. Wow. And so you've got to imagine that this shapes the mindset of a nation. They do not like being forced by foreigners. They'll suffer at the hands of their own leaders, but they do not like being forced to suffer at the hands of foreigners. And again, this is a society which endured the siege of Leningrad, which endured the siege of Stalingrad.
It's very interesting that the Eastern Europeans haven't necessarily prospered either. They have done rather poorly, many of them. And we just saw that recently in Hungary, they have a new nationalist authoritarian government that's seeking closer ties with Russia, because over 20 years of their Western orientation, they have not seen prosperity.
Putin is not a communist. He is much more of a fascist. He adheres very similarly to a lot of the fundamental tenets of fascism, as was dictated by Giovanni Gentile and Benito Mussolini, which was independent nationalism, which is one of the reasons why it appeals to a lot of these Eastern European countries, because countries like Romania is one of the poorest countries in Eastern Europe. What did they get at the end of the Cold War? They got rid of a horrible dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, but they're still poor. They're still impoverished. Yeah. And now Putin comes to power and he says, look, I don't care what political system you have. As long as you are not an American sock puppet, I don't care. So he's willing to support authoritarian nationalist governments. And if they look out for their people, that's fine. As long as they're not going to put a NATO missile base. They don't need to have a Russian base. They don't need to be communists and take people's private land. As long as they have a government which is not going to harbor a NATO missile base, the Russians really don't care, which is also why
non-ideological approach we also see in how U.S. policy has forced Putin into the arms of China. He was just there and he just signed a bunch of trade deals with them, and a key deal between Russia and China is for the Russians to supply China with natural gas via a new pipeline. And this is really tying these countries together. And as you point out, they're not ideologically on the same wavelength, but they have a common adversary, the United States.
We could do business with the Russians. We should be doing business with the Russians, because the Russians are Europeans. And when I say Europeans, I don't mean in terms of race. They are one of the most ethnically diverse societies on the planet. Indeed, they're a melting pot just like we are. And they're European in the sense that they're Western. They share our same values in terms of freedom of religion. Okay, so you can't go out and criticize the president, but you can be a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, a Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, or Wiccan if you want. And nobody's going to come and burn your church. In fact, in Russia, it is a crime to desecrate any religious site. I mean, a crime by which you can be thrown in jail just for desecrating somebody's religious site. Now, on the other hand, in China, they murder Christians, they murder Muslims, they murder Buddhists. The Chinese are a racist society. They've murdered hundreds of thousands, if not a million or more, Tibetans. They've ethnically cleansed Tibet of Tibetans. China and Russia are not natural allies. In fact, Russia and the West are natural allies. The common country that we should really be watching out for in terms of its anti-Western system, its anti-Western values, is China. But the only reason that Russia has been drawn into China's arms is because both countries don't like the United States.
Well, Marshawn, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. You can sign up for podcasts of this series via iTunes and Radio For All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Cataferro, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.